My father is very fond of spiked heads, especially those of people who have annoyed him in some fashion. And a face as noble as yours, well, no doubt he saw you decorating the city wall above Kingsgate. I think you would have looked very striking. Welcome to the White Book Podcast, the original A Game of Thrones LCG podcast. Originally founded in 2010 as Two Champs and a Chump, we decided to rebrand when the game relaunched with the second edition. A huge thank you goes out to Fantasy Flight Games and George R. R. Martin for this game and world we love, and of course to my co-hosts and you, the listeners. Please, if you enjoy the show, leave us a review on iTunes or your platform of choice, comment on our Facebook threads, or even better, support us on Patreon. We love turning that kind of support back into the community. This is Season 10 of the White Book Podcast.
That's a Tyrion quote?
That is. That is Tyrion and Jeremy Riker banter. So there you go. You know, I'm actually kinda sad here. I thought for sure there would be some good quotes involving the gates because frankly there's just so many damn mentions of the gates of King's Landing. But it is really hard to sort through the cruft to find something worthwhile, so you know what? I think that's a challenge to the listeners. Find a good quote about the gates and post it in the comments.
Good luck with that.
Yeah. It could be tough.
Well, that cough was me, Roy Rogers.
I'm not coughing, always, but I'm Aaron Glazer. Well,
whoa! Madness!
I missed like an episode and a half. Let's relax.
Well, it's a review episode.
It's been like a month.
I think when Aaron quit the show, like he was on the very next episode because it was a review episode.
Did listeners ever know I quit the show is the real question.
Well, yes, because you did a whole episode that was like quitting.
No, I didn't.
And then
not at the level that Luke did.
I didn't do an episode quitting at all.
I thought you did like a props and slop segment that was like, this is going to be one of my last episodes.
No, that never happened, Roy. That literally exists in your head.
It must be in my head. I must have dreamed it. I saw it in a dream.
Yeah, that's how the White Book's going to end. It was all a dream.
But Glazer's back. I missed him. You missed him.
I mean,
we all missed him.
No one missed me because literally, like, okay.
I'm just going to stop there.
Because I literally missed no episodes as far as listeners are aware.
It you know, as far as since you're only scheduled for every other week and all, I suppose in actual episode releases, it hasn't been much.
Like, and we never told listeners, so like, it's really just like Roy being like, Glazer was gone, and everyone else being like, huh? This is a thing?
Well, in our defense for not telling listeners, I think everyone agreed, you know what? Give Aaron a little bit of time. I'm sure he'll be back.
Once there's cards to talk about, he'll definitely
be back. I like talking about cards.
He does.
Yeah. Hey guys, so before we get to the actual chapter pack review, we actually have another review this episode.
Look at that. You get a 2-4. It's reviews all the time this week on the White Book. And this one is a little bit different. It's the first time I've really ever done this sort of thing. So bear with me here a little bit. But this is actually a quick review for a Game of Thrones, let's say, related game. You know, the let's say maybe the redheaded cousin no one wants to talk about, but not actually made by FFG, and let's point out, not actually licensed as a Game of Thrones game. Still, it is closely related enough that I think a lot of our listeners would be kind of intrigued by this. So, full disclosure, I'm not paid for this review in any strictly traditional sense of the way, but the company Atlas Games did send me a couple copies of earlier editions of games in this family. So, what family is that? That's Gloom. They are working on a new game titled Gloom of Thrones. Now, I don't know, you may be in the same boat that I was, which is that you've heard of Gloom, you're sort of vaguely aware of it in the gaming space, and that it's a little bit more popular, a smaller, faster, light card game, but you really don't know anything about it past that. I think at some point I was somewhat aware that it was made with these translucent cards so that you can like stack them to do different things, which now that I'm fully aware of that and have played some games and had them physically in my hand, I honestly have to say it's really pretty cool. I really like that particular aspect of things. I don't know if any of the rest of you that have dabbled in a bajillion card games like I have remember an old Wizards of the Coast entry from the early 2000s titled Hecatomb, where the flavor of that was kind of like you were a Frankenstein, Dr. Frankenstein-esque mad scientist who was stitching together a monster out of all these pieces, and then, you know, they would duke it out and stuff. And it allowed you with these very interesting, I believe they were pentangular cards, though they may have been hexagons. Anyway, they were clear, so you could stack, and that was how you could mix and match monster pieces, right, as different things overlapped each other. I thought it was a super cool game. Blew my mind back in the day that they could do cards like that in both the shape and the material and stuff. So anyway, I had a soft spot for that type of mechanic without digressing way too hard into Hecatomb, which sadly died before it could live a long, full life. But anyway, so Gloom operates in a similar way with these cards that stack and give you modifiers, bonuses, and abilities and such that are effective based on whether or not they can be seen. So you can like stack additional cards on top of them to cover up other values and abilities. And so only the ones you can see actually function. So that's the idea here structurally that I think's kind of cool. The game itself, Base Gloom, is, as I said, a light, kind of fun, fast card game. Seems like a good one to sit around and have beers with some buddies while playing. I didn't do that. Instead, Kristen and I played some games. I was not enjoying beer and pretzels or pizza or burgers or more beer, but I wish I could have been. I'm going to have to try it again like that. So the game revolves around, the base game revolves around you taking charge of a family and trying to basically have the most depressing life possible and then for everybody to die, and you win by everyone in your family dying and then you having the least points, basically, the greatest negative value on your points, which is a small tweak, you know, mathematically, but interesting from a flavor perspective. So the guys over at Atlas Games evidently took a look at the Game of Thrones world and wanted to strike while the iron was hot, so to speak, and thought, man, that kind of flavor of everybody dying really fits the Song of Ice and Fire universe. Obviously, they can't license it, and the tone is already pretty tongue-in-cheek on these games, so it seemed ripe for a parody, I would assume. And I think they definitely did so. So I've got a copy here in front of me, and they have created these parody cards that very obviously reference a lot of things that many of us know and love in the series. So the different families here, for instance, the Bannisters instead of the Lannisters. So you've got Tywin Bannister, whose flavor text is "Get rich or die, Tywin." Oh yeah. So a lot of these are kind of let's say dad joke, groaner sort of level, but like I love that kind of flavor. So we've also got Seriously Bannister, who says, "I'm here to hug my children and blow stuff up, and I'm all out of children." So like there's stuff really at that kind of level, which is pretty sweet. There's, for instance, Head Snark, their play on Ned, who's noted as an honorable family man and whose quote is, "This, my children, is Chekhov's chopping block." So I just want to say props to Atlas for drawing my attention to a like narrative device of the first novel, Game of Thrones, that I had actually never really processed before, that Ned opens with the beheading and the chopping block, foreshadowing his own later beheading. So, spoiler alert there, guys. But there's a lot of entertaining kind of in-gags like that. Like, let's see, Gluten Snark, who appears to be their brand knockoff, is listed as a Fallout Boy. Oh, zinger. So for the most part, I think those are really kind of tongue-in-cheek thematic wins, though I do take a small bit of beef at Kelly C instead of, alluding to Khaleesi instead of Daenerys. I'm sure it was much harder to come up with a gag for Daenerys, but virtually everyone else is operating off of their name rather than their title. So, you know, oh well, I suppose you can't win them all. So the in-deck cards also make very similar sort of jokes. There's things like "knew nothing," "woke the dragon," "drank themselves to death," "the seed is strong," "seduced by a sibling," "intruded on incest," things like that, that make very clear references to the Game of Thrones world without necessarily using copyrighted stuff. Now, mechanically, the game appears to be virtually the same as the base game. These cards offer, you know, some different titles and names and such that kind of tweak that flavor, but their mechanics all work the same. You're giving your people some negative modifiers, maybe some positive modifiers to your opponents, and then you're eventually hoping to play one of the death cards and say have one of your own characters drink themselves to death while they are worth a mountain of negative points. Now, the one new thing that they did add here is kind of a fight over the throne. In this case, the porcelain throne, which is kind of amusing in itself. So some of the actual deck cards are going to include these little crown icons on them. And so as those cards are played, the porcelain throne will move to whatever character that was just played on. So it can bounce around to everybody, and it gives a large amount of negative points, negative 50, and a couple in-game abilities that let you tweak things like being able to play an untimely death as your second card. But that's kind of a pacing thing. You need to really sit down and play the game, I think, to understand why that's relevant. But regardless, it's neat to make the throne kind of a central aspect of the game and have it bounce around from character to character and as they squabble back and forth over it. I love the kind of tongue-in-cheek tone here. And part of what they recommend that you do is that you actually turn it into a storytelling game, right? And as you play one of these cards and say, you know, your character woke the dragon, then you explain how they actually did that. And for somebody that also likes to dabble in role-playing games and storytelling games, like, say, Fall of Magic, if anybody's tried that, I think that's really cool and can lead, you know, if you have a fun, jokey group, particularly if some beers are involved, can probably lead to some really hilarious stuff. But on the flip side, part of me almost actually wishes this was a straight, serious game that could be used for some actual, like, world-building, storytelling stuff. Like I said, I really love Fall of Magic, which is a game similarly that sort of just provides prompts as you go for you to tell these vignettes about what's happening. So I think if somebody wanted to play this straight and like dream up an alternate universe history of the World of Ice and Fire or something, there's probably some really cool potential there. But that's always me trying to figure out how to do something that extra step beyond the rules as written. As written, though, it was a very fun, quick little game that I think, despite the jokey tone, really captures a lot of the Thrones flavor in a humorous way and rewards a lot of knowledge of that source material so you can catch the gags that they're making, but it does require you to enjoy that level of pun based humor, which I really do. So I think I definitely recommend it. They are normally sold at a very reasonable price point because these are, as I said, small light card games. I know this particular game, the reason they wanted to get folks out reviewing it, is that it's about to go up on Kickstarter on April 2nd. So we're going to be dropping this review the weekend right before this goes live, basically. So you folks are going to be thinking about it if you're interested. So hop on over there. I don't know the details of the rewards and pricing and whatever extras they're going to offer on Kickstarter like most folks normally do. Don't know. I'm not that level of marketing shill for them. I just enjoyed the flavor of this game and enjoyed the chance to finally get around to learning this game that I was vaguely aware of and had never actually sat down to play before. So if you're looking for something that you could probably take to the bar after Game of Thrones tournament and sit around and BS with some people and have a good time, I think this would be a great candidate for that. Hey, and if nothing else, those plastic translucent cards are going to be real easy to clean if you spill beer on them. So enjoy, guys.
We have a pack of cards for you today, listeners.
Whoa, transition.
Boy, do we.
Well, what episode number is this?
This is episode 373 of White Book.
Jesus Christ, Will. We gotta get you a new hobby.
Yeah. Oh, sweet. I will get to be on episode 375. That's sweet.
Yeah, maybe we'll figure out something a little different from normal for a multiple 25, and start planning now for episode 400. We better do something big because that number just for some reason feels almost incomprehensible to me.
Yeah, that's what in the fall, right?
Yeah, should be give or take 6 months or so from now.
You should send a media request to Martin now.
Oh, that's not a bad idea. It would be really good to get him on again. And things like Ringer make it super easy, so at least from the other person's end, most of the time. Sometimes, I guess.
Mm-hmm. That was very convincing.
You know what? They're not very reliable. We've already had to change software once tonight with just us, and we do this every week.
It's true. So would you say that we are at the gates of a new episode?
Oh,
all right, I quit again. That was quick.
What are you talking about? That is the smoothest Roy has ever been.
Yeah, but is that really like a plus?
No. So, everyone, this is the sixth cycle, right?
Yeah, I believe so.
So this is the sixth cycle. Dance of the Shadows, I think, is what this is called, or something along those lines.
Maybe
the first cycle names. The first pack of the second shadow cycle in the Shadows block, at the very least. And it's a really interesting pack. At the gates has got some really interesting cards. But you know, we wanted to spice up our review a little bit just for Chris Thompson, who hates the reviews but still listens to everyone. And we thought we would do things a little differently. Will, how are we doing it differently this time?
Well, you know, I admit we do peter out in the back half of the episode often in pack reviews as time crouches in. So we are going to do these in alphabetical order this time rather than pack review order. Just alphabetical by faction, that is. We're not going all the way down to So that should shake it up a bit.
Cool. So that means we start with House Baratheon, or Baratheon, which has two cards. The first is a one gold location, non-unique, loyal Kingsgate. Thankfully not the Kingsgate. It is King's Landing Limited. It has a challenges action. If you have five or more power on your faction card, sacrifice Kingsgate to draw two cards, plus one gold. And then Barra also has this character, R'hllor Infiltrator, which is another non-unique character, but this one's non-loyal. And it costs two gold. It has a red and a green icon and one strength. It's a R'hllor, surprise, surprise, spy, also very surprising based on its name. Dominance action, kneel R'hllor Infiltrator to choose an opponent. Give control of R'hllor Infiltrator to that player and gain one power for your faction.
Whoa.
I think we should probably rewind a little bit to Kingsgate. What's really interesting about this pack is it's for the first time in the history of the game, all of the new limited economy from the new cycle of limited economy in the cycle comes out of one pack, which I think is going to be really interesting for the meta. They're all these one gold, do something in faction, draw two cards as a challenges action, limited, and the plus one gold. I'm a little skeptical of these cards, actually, in general. I'm not super fond of the Barra one. I think it already puts Barra in a pretty, like, Barra's already in a pretty good position. It's Barra, like, Barra's not being held back by its draw, it's being held back by its economy. And I don't think Kingsgate really gives it the payoff. We'll get to some other factions that this draw to, you know, have some early economy on setup or early economy on the first turn. Has much easier triggers. But like, if you have five more power in your faction card, I don't think that is a very like useful metric for Baratheon. And I wish it was somewhat like more interesting. And I just really don't think this is the economy card Barra was praying for. I think it's really interesting that Danny decided to go into this like utility limited location. You know, like he experimented in the last cycle with City Gates, and this is sort of like a continuation of that cycle now going into specific faction themes. But I think these are going to end up, except for the Night's Watch one, landing a little flat. but I could be wrong. I'd like to hear what you guys have to say about that before we jump into the Barracuda character, because I think we should talk maybe a little bit in general front up about these economy cards and the Barra one in particular.
I might prefer to just do that.
Your return. Go ahead.
I'd rather just do them all at once, I think. Is that crazy? Not do them all at once. I'd rather do them as we go.
But I was just talking about, in general, though. Well, we're going to talk specifically about them, but, they share, a design space.
Yeah, that's fair. I think they're boring. I think that these are seed cards for later in the game when certain other cards get rotated out. The two cost unlimited, specifically.
Fair.
I don't think that they're nearly as good, but I think that is their intended purpose. I think the two cost unlimited will cycle out relatively soon. Right? I guess not relatively soon. Eventually.
It would be the second rotation.
So this is giving us, that buys them another 2 years of not having to worry about just more econ stuff, which I think is the goal.
Cool.
Hopefully, maybe, I don't know. At this point, they keep dropping more and more econ stuff on us. Are they setting a precedent where they're trying to build up to a point and then just stop? Or are they setting a precedent where they want to just keep throwing a different angle on it at us over and over and over? I'm almost leaning toward the latter.
I think there's a limited design space in the limited keyword. I think Aaron's probably right that this is designed for a little bit of a power creeped down version of limited economy from the two cost limiteds that we got in cycle three. And I think Danny is also just sort of playing around with this idea of these utility limited cards, because right now most of the limited cards are just pure economy cards. This is an attempt to create something that, you know, when you top deck this later in the game, it's not necessarily a dead card. You can convert it in the challenges phase to other cards. Something like, again, that space that he initially explored with City Gates, which sadly ended up failing as a limited card, so far at least. Maybe once we hit rotation or maybe two rotations down the road, City Gates will see more play, but it definitely has failed as a card. But I expect to see the limited design space Danny goes to next is something closer to the Night's Watch card, but we can talk about that later.
Well, from the top level wider perspective here, there are a couple thoughts that I think you're really close to there with some of your observations. One was City Gates, being that, you know, that was a card I was very excited about when it dropped, and I was fairly excited about these when they were first kind of starting to get previewed or spoiled. And I think we're at kind of a weird spot where theoretically being in-house is a benefit for these locations, Kingsgate and others, but their usage to draw directly correlates to usage of that limited keyword, like you were mentioning earlier. Like, there is a very real trade-off that you're blowing your limited card on that, which means since you're then sacrificing it and losing the econ, then, you know, that benefit is really only to the late game, as you said, versus City Gates that never quite got there, that is, you know, a discard from hand ability, so it's not using up that limited spot, which your play for the turn, that is. Which means that these are, gosh, maybe worse from that perspective. I mean, theoretically, drawing two and actually being up a card is nice, but this just doesn't... Thrones doesn't scale out the same way from kind of these economy trade-off perspectives that other games like Magic does. And I know that Danny is a real big Magic guy from what I've heard in the past, and when I look at the these kind of repeated designs of these econ locations we're getting for houses. I definitely kind of see that vibe where, you know, Magic keeps iterating over and over on, you know, what's this different slant we can have on these, like, you know, dual mana locations of some kind, right? You have the old dual lands, you wind up with pain lands, shock lands, tap lands, so on and so forth. And I feel like he's kind of iterating on that. And, you know, on the one hand, gosh, trying to put this thought together completely since I didn't do it beforehand, is that Magic scales in a linear sense from an econ perspective, right? So you're playing one land per turn, barring the occasional card effect that mucks with that. And all of the resources you have available to you are directly predicated upon that, right? They both scale at the same rate. Again, barring the occasional, you know, dark ritual or whatever. But Thrones doesn't scale that same way. So I really feel like any of these sort of side effects that use up your limited play for the turn have an outsize difference on your economic and board development. Like in Magic, if I blew my one land on the turn on something similar to a Kingsgate play or something, right? I'm down one mana from what my opponent had available, which is certainly noticeable, but not as big as, say, I drop a Kingsgate, pop it to get two cards, versus my opponent dropping, I don't know, Redwood Straits or something, right? Like the econ advantage doesn't line up the same way in the two games, which makes me worry that any of these limited, like, bonus effect cards are not going to quite get there without some real work to that.
So I think I agree with everything Will said. Sorry if that's not great radio, but I think you're just right. Like, I think...
Small note to everybody, Aaron didn't listen to a
word of that. No, like, I think you're right. I think that this is Magic design. Look, I'm not going to repeat everything you said to prove I was listening. That's awkward as hell, right? I am definitely also...
Yeah, I'm just kidding.
Sentinels of the Multiverse of Oblivion came out today, and I am 100% also playing that. But I am mildly capable of multitasking. I just think Will is right. These are interesting space that I don't think are especially good, ultimately. I also, like, just to get a little more specific, I think the Mara one is in particular bad. Like, I don't think Mara can afford to get limited choked. I don't think they can super afford to, like, wait to use the... I don't know what I'm supposed to do with this card, right? Like, I mean, I'd rather have City Gates than this in a Mara deck. Because if I'm top decking it late game, I'd much rather have that immediate draw. Whereas some of the others can basically work immediately if I feel like I'm set up otherwise. I think Barra got the short end of the econ stick again here, and it's very sad. Like, I don't know. I think Barra's is just a bad card. And can I move on to Roller Infiltrator, or do you want to keep talking about these econ?
I mean, I think... Yeah, no, I don't know that I have much else to say. Just... They're already in a tight spot with Econ, and this doesn't trade off. Doesn't help.
Roller Infiltrator is an okay card. I could see decks where it sees a little bit of play. I don't think you use it early. I think you use it for Mel, and then, like, if you need that extra power, if you're trying to do something, you play it. It's okay because it's two cost, and I don't think there's any other two cost roller. So, given that it's the only two cost roller, I think it has a decent spot in some of those decks. Outside of that, it's kind of strictly worse than the Vanguard Lancer. But, like, it does have some decent icons that Barra doesn't really mind having, and it's the right cost. So, it's not a bad card. Right?
Oh, can you hear me? I'm sorry. This is not strictly worse than... than the Vanguard, because this gives you a power, right? It gives you closing speed. Like, if there's, like I think one of the problems when I've been playing Barra recently is sometimes Barra can, or played against Barra, is sometimes Barra can get stuck. I mean, Starry Sept has helped a little bit with this, but Barrett can sometimes get stuck at like 12, 13 power, like where they're just not really able to just like close a game, where they're able to get a snowbally early advantage, you know, by kneeling things out, by keeping the board somewhat controlled, but then like they just get overpowered by the econ advantages and the big guys of other and the stand and all this kind of stuff. And so they get stalled out. But the ability to basically get a kneel and then get one additional power that can put you to 13 or 14, and then you can and then you can close from there is really powerful. And we've learned consistently that almost all of these passive power effects end up being more powerful than we think they are. So I think that that Rulor Infiltrator is a really interesting card. I definitely agree with Glazer that it's a late game play. The switch effect is a late game play. But I think you'll end up seeing this in Mel decks. Old core Mel, to be clear. Yeah.
I mean, I don't know that I have anything new there. Two cost Rulor is very interesting for just, you know, that trait and seeing that cost slot there. I like the icons here. This is a combination that we've not really seen for Vera at a low cost point like this. At a two cost point anyway. So I like that. And I'm intrigued to see what this does in melee. I definitely think it could help snipe a victory, but also the ability to give cards of any kind to another player is, I think, something to kind of watch there. So I'm going to keep my eyes peeled for what sort of weird interactions might crop up with that.
And it does help the non-loyal bearer passive power module. That, you know, is always threatening to come back in. Like, you know, we've got Martell Stag is, you know, remains a deck that is always threatening to be an important part of the metagame. But also other decks like Tyrell Stag, excuse me, are also just like a couple cards short. And, you know, with Old Town and this and Chamber and Chair, like these are just like the ability to pick up three or four power in the mid to late turns can really speed up the clock that those decks present. So I wouldn't be surprised that if this card sees play. It's definitely stronger than the Econ card, which I would put Vera at a C overall.
I think I'm at D. I just don't love these cards. Like, I like one of them, and the other one is a card that exists.
I guess I didn't really give them a rating, huh?
Did I?
You know, I think probably just a C overall here. That's nothing super wow, but, you know, probably serviceable.
That's fair.
Okay. Does that kick us over to...
Greyjoy and the Iron Gate.
Okay, well, I guess Aaron predicated part of his return this week on not having to read anything.
I'll read. I'm just not reading Greyjoy. Like, since when do I pretend Greyjoy is a house I give a shit about? They're the most boring thing in the game.
Not that I know.
I also super hate one of these cards, but whatever.
It's definitely this first one. We've got Iron Gate. That one's the one drop econ location for Greyjoy. King's Landing Trait Limited. Challenge section. If your first player sacrifice Iron Gate to draw two cards. And then the recently previewed Baylor Blacktide. Four cost, four strength, military, and power icons. Captain and the seven traits. And each opponent cannot play copies of events that are his or her discard pile. Also, he's not loyal. Starting here between these two, probably with the location, I think the Iron Gate here is in a little bit of the same boat as the Barrow one is, actually. You know, the trigger is not too hard for them, though it is one you're going to be actively fighting over your opponent on. It It's not entirely under your control. So there may be times you can't play that, whether it's early, mid, or late game. But the thing that really stops me here is, you know, Greyjoy's got a little bit of a weakness on the econ front, too, thanks to wanting all those big bodies. And blowing that limited play on a card you're just going to sack for draw, that can be rough. Baylor, on the other hand, I really like. He seems like a useful tool, but I can't help but wonder if he's not a little bit inferior to Triss. You know, your opponent can't play. I mean, I guess you're stopping all events in their discard pile while Baylor is out instead of one at a time with Triss. But Triss sidesteps something like Isle of Ravens or Myrinese Market that's so popular right now, that I think Baylor, you know, you would have to be playing a pretty dedicated, like, mill deck to dump a bunch in at once to really get a stronger benefit here than Triss. So that's where I stand.
I think the Iron Gate's definitely better than the Barrow one, because I think the way Greyjoy decks are constructed going forward is going to bring back to wanting to have at least the option to make itself first player consistently. You know, with new Euron, with just the power of a lot of, you know, of where Greyjoy is, like Greyjoy Sea of Blood is just so strong. Greyjoy Crossing is so strong. These all are decks that have inclinations to go first. And it does help smooth Greyjoy's, but Greyjoy also has draw issues. If something bad happens to Asha or you, she's at the bottom 20 cards of your deck. So unlike Barrow, which I think its problem wasn't draw, it had very good draw cards. Its problem was economy. So it needs just a straightforwardly good economy card, and it got a middling at best one. Greyjoy had both an economy and a draw problem, which makes Iron Gate much more appealing, I think. And then, of course, Baylor, I got to disagree with Will a little bit. I don't think he's a crappier version of Triss, because I think he does some similar work, but provides redundancy for that effect, and also just hoses combo and decks that rely specifically on control events. Which, you know, we will see out of Martell, of course, the control side of things, a combo out of Tyrell, or even Hyper Viper and things like that. So I think in that case, Baylor is good. He's also strong against Targaryen. So I can see why Glazer hates him, because he definitely hurts orange cards a lot. But I think in a Targ-infested meta, which we used to have, and a combo infested meta that we had probably when this card was designed, Baylor feels like a breath of fresh air. I just wish he was a Stark card or a Barra card or literally any other faction than Greyjoy, because again, Greyjoy is now this faction that is starting to get answers to just about every problem. And Baylor being there as well just makes it just like, why aren't you playing Squid cards? When you can play Vince, you can play Triss, you can play Baylor. These are all easy answers to your – these are easy reactive cards to what your opponent's doing, and you have really strong proactive cards. So I don't like that Baylor is a Squid card, but I think he's a very, very powerful card otherwise.
I got to slip in here for a minute and say I do not think Baylor is better against Targ than Triss is. When they've got – Myrinese Market's floating around, which is just legitimately great for them to play to begin with. So all they've got to do is dump their Dracarys or whatever back into their deck so that they're able to keep playing them. I think Baylor is weaker in that matchup than Triss.
I mean, then you start playing first player games, right? If it's Triss versus Myrinese Market, it's whoever's the first player.
Sure, but that's at least something. Like, Baylor just doesn't interact with that at all.
Right, it does, but it, you know, if, all right, they did their Dracarys, but that means that their Dragon Is No Slave is turned off. It means that their Hand's judgments are turned off. It means that they're put to the sword if they're running Sea of Blood is turned off, or they're put to the torch is turned off if they're putting Dracarys in. Like it, I think it slows them down. It provides
depends on
it just how many Mirny's targets really right. play.
Plus, right. plus
and how a, many markets they have.
Right, right, and whether they're also playing Isle of Ravens for the shuffle, which you know some probably are. But as far as the dragon is no slave, didn't I read that you would be able to return a dragon is no slave to your hand because that's not playing the event, even if it is in your discard pile. So,
but
I mean, you've also got some play there if you're targ to kind of get around Baelor.
Yeah, that's fair. What do you got for us, Glazer?
Baelor is fine, and I honestly don't think he really sees play. When he was first revealed, he kind of freaked me out as a Murtal player. I thought he was going to be way, way too strong, but like he doesn't do anything that Greyjoy already can't do better. And he's kind of, for them, a terrible body. Like, if they're running him and they're not running, I don't know, the Knight, or if they're not running Carl the Maid, or like what's Jesse's card, the Drowned God one? Jesse's favorite card, the one where you kneel it and kill something.
Old Grey Gull.
Like, I think he's just a worse card than all of those at the end of the day. And like if Targ wasn't in the meta and like Kohor is all over the place and Sea of Blood are all over the place and they're all running to Isle of Ravens. So without those, like, the case, I think he would really bust the meta. And when Isle of Ravens rotates, I reserve the right to reassess this. Right now, I don't think he's great. Iron Gate might be way too good. I think it is the best of these. I think that with At the Gates, Greyjoy can quickly have enough economy and just use this as the boost and then draw a stupid amount of cards in the mid-game. They should be able to use this to burst draw, like, 4 at some point in the game. I think that this is going to be a problem card. I think Iron Gate is great, and Baelor is kind of bad, so I'm going to average that out to about a B-.
That seems fair. I think B fits pretty well with this pack for Greyjoy.
For the moment, I think I'm going to lean harder on that B- angle, though. I agree with Aaron that this sort of thing probably needs revisited once Isle of Ravens rotates.
I actually want to call just a quick attention to, like, Iron Besides At the Gates, We Do Not Sow. Also, like, it gives an additional, like, the ability to return your own limited cards into play with We Do Not Sow. Or not We Do Not Sow. What's it called?
We Take Westeros.
Is definitely a very powerful play. And this gives a very juicy target for that. You know, to be able to go trigger my, you know, your opponent doesn't have very many good locations to steal, so you go trigger my Iron Gate, draw 2 cards, and your next plot is We Take Westeros. You get the +1 gold, but you can get it for free. You have a 5 gold, good initiative, and then you're going to see 2 more cards in the challenges action and get the gold is really powerful. So, Iron Gate definitely synergizes with what Greyjoy wants to be doing right now.
Yeah, that's a good point with We Do Not So. I mean, it's already a great plot, sure. And at that point, it's kind of compares a little bit to You Win or You Die, which is interesting.
All right, Aaron, do you want to read the Lannister cards?
I mean, I'd much rather read the House After Lannister cards, if you don't mind.
All right, I'll read the Lannister cards. All right, so we've got 1 gold. So we got our 1 gold thing here, which is the Lion Gate. Surprise, surprise. Or it's not. It's just Lion Gate. Excuse me. It's loyal, King's Landing, 1 gold, limited, challenges action. If you control 2 or more cards in Shadows, sacrifice Lion Gate to draw 2 cards, +1 gold. And then a 4-cost, unique, red and green, 4-strength, non-loyal, Kingsguard character and a knight, Sir Mandon Moore. He has Shadow 3. And the reaction, after Sir Mandon Moore comes out of Shadows, choose an opponent. That player must choose and kill a character he or she controls unless he or she chooses and discards 2 cards from his or her hand. Very strong, I think Mandon Moore is. I think he slots into a Lanny Shadows pressure build. That's definitely like the Lanny Kraken deck that, you know, Jesse and Platt are constantly threatening is going to be really good. This is a card that slots in there, you know, alongside Every Store Champ's favorite card, Sir Robert Strong, and it's, you know, providing just additional cards you want out of Shadows. Of course, you have the Shadows event to put Sir Mandon Moore back into Shadows for free alongside anything else that you want. Very strong. I expect to probably see him be at least a one of in these pressure Shadows builds that are coming out of Lannister. There may also be Banner Lion Shadows builds, maybe a Martell Lion that would play him. And then I think Lion Gate is okay. The two or more, it lives or dies in its value because Lannister does want to draw cards. It lives or dies based on whether or not Shadows is good in primary Lannister. I don't know if it's going to be good. I have a hope that we see some really cool Shadows Lannister builds by the end through this
cycle. Did you just say you want Lannister?
I'm for Lannister. Like, I'm trying to be objective here. I never want people to play red cards, just like I never want people to play squid cards. But, like, I think that Shadows Lannister is an interesting place for it to go. I hope that's a build that emerges. I mean, Danny seems to be begging for us to play with these Shadows cards, but they just haven't come together in a consistent way, right, Aaron? Or am I missing something?
I think
like Lanny Kraken was fine, but not great.
They might be more real than we think. I don't know for sure. I've played against a couple decent Lannister builds, so I think there's real hope for them.
Do you think these cards help?
Ultimately, kind of no, like if I'm being honest. I think they're mostly just bad. But, like, I don't know. Like, I don't know if you can play Lionsgate even in the draw deck, because, like, that deck is just so gold greedy. Like, you see, like, 15 gold cards, and you're like, oh, that may be enough, and I still need to run Trade Routes as my restricted. So I don't think you can run Lionsgate in that deck. Maybe if it were plus two, but not a plus one. And Sir Mandon is good. But, like, I don't know. He's really just power for Cersei, and that Cersei's not in the Shadows deck, right? Like, or I guess you run him with the other Cersei, and then, like, when he comes out of play, he discards a card, then they don't have two cards to discard.
Two cards? Yeah. Oh, you mean, you trigger Cersei.
You trigger Shadow Cersei.
You trigger the Shadow Cersei.
And then, like, if they don't have two cards, does the kills just happen?
Yep.
I mean, then Mandon Moore is really good and might push them over the top, but Lionsgate is totally unplayable. Like, even in a Shadows deck, I don't think you can play Lionsgate.
I mean, that just goes back to that limited play per turn, that limited slot, as it were, is so important. It's a big trade-off. It's, gosh, arguably a bigger trade-off than a faction card, Neil? There's a debate for the ages, maybe. I don't know.
I don't know about that.
And that's me sidelining this anyway. But focusing on the cards, I want to really like the Lionsgate. Lanny needs this draw, but the trade-off is so big that I'm not sure. On the plus side, though, I do love that it is a trigger that is entirely under your control. Which we haven't seen in these so far. So I like that. It feels like a little bit of a boost to a faction that needs something there. But it's predicated, like you guys said, on Shadows being a thing. Mandon Moore, though, I really like. This feels to me like the sort of card that Lannister needs more of to take advantage of some of their older card pool, where you're really putting real board pressure on your opponent or chucking a notable amount of cards from their hand, which plays into the big, like, glut of cards that Lannister has gotten that only trigger when they have more cards in hand, which is very hard for such a, these days, draw light house to manage. So something like this that either discards en masse or, you know, takes stuff out of the board, forcing your opponent to commit harder, you know, a few more of these would really help. But this one, I really like on its own merits. I think it's thanks to the superior Shadows timing in second edition, I don't think it's going to be all that hard to use him very effectively.
He's definitely pretty brutal in a Marshall phase after a reset.
Yeah, exactly. If you somehow manage to get initiative and go first, and then so you've got the gold and then pass to them, they could really be hurting.
So I'd probably give Lannister here C+. I'm gonna grade them a little bit on the other side. C+.
I think I'm gonna give them a B. I think ultimately Mandan Moore is going to end up being really good. And that counts for an awful lot. Like, I think a really good Mandan Moore does an awful lot for Lannister, given how many different types of decks he goes in. So, yeah, I don't think anything else good is really super happening here, but I think Mandan Moore is good enough to give them a B, because he might be an A card, and the non-limited blah.
All right, Glazer, lay us on the orange cards.
All right. Whoa, can I slip in a B- there real quick before you...
Oh, sorry, Rob, I thought you said it, yep.
That's all. B-. I'm kind of right there in the middle between you guys, so carry on.
Southern Escort, 4/4, Mill Intrigue, Shadow 4. Discard another card from Shadows, put Southern Escort into play from Shadows. And Rivergate is the one cost limited. If you have lost two or more trials this phase, sack Rivergate to draw two cards. Southern Escort, go ahead.
Plus one gold.
Yeah, sorry. They're all plus one gold. Southrun Escort is real good. It's in a Shadows. It goes in every Martell's City of Shadows build basically forever. It means that like cards in Shadows that are dead or otherwise useless are not, or otherwise not useful at the moment, are not dead. And it also, with whether you have gold or not, screws up the math of any Sea of Blood opponents really, really effectively. That this is a guard is really cool, even though the guard tech in Martell is real bad right now because Greyjoy can just go second whenever
that... It is a guard!
Yeah, Greyjoy can just go second whenever the hell they want to because they have 800 initiative boosts now. So, like, the choice of going second isn't really yours. But, like, this card is still really, really good for that Shadows build. It obviously goes nowhere else but City of Shadows. Wait, what the hell is that? That's first edition. What's this called? Assault from the Shadows.
Yeah.
Assault from the Shadows
is phenomenal with Southron Escort. Rivergate's fine, I guess. I don't know. I'm not really planning. Look, beyond maybe the Greyjoy one, like, unless something changes, we're reading these and something comes to me, I'm totally not really planning on playing any of the others. They're just worse ecom than stuff we already have.
The Stark one's pretty good.
We'll get there. But yeah, I'm not playing Rivergate, so I don't care. But I'm going to give the house a B- just because I really, really, really think the Southrun Escort is great for a build I really enjoy.
This card is gross. Like, Southrun Escort is a gross card. Like, the ability to get a 4-strength Bicon at the cost of discarded card from Shadows at any time that you want is obnoxious. Like, the ability, like, it just screws up not just Sea of Blood math, but all challenge math.
Maybe not power.
Not power challenge math, pardon me. But it just, this is such dangerous design space. Largely free characters are just dangerous space. Like, we've already seen The power of
The
Septon.
I thought you were going to go with the closest analogy. Mm-mm.
No, because this doesn't like a card in Shadows isn't board presence, right? But so you're not sacrificing any board presence. It's a resource. Don't get me wrong. There is a resource cost to this, but it's not. You don't lose any board for this, and the ability to just do it as an any phase action is just obnoxious. Like, I just do not like this design space. I think this card is really powerful, and I think Glazer is absolutely right. I think you will see it in City of Shadows build or City of Shadows. Jeez, you got me, Glazer. Assault from the Shadows builds. And because the ability to throw garbage cards into Shadows with the agenda, it's like, oh, okay, I don't need the second limited card that I drew. I'll put it in the Shadows, and then I'll use that to bring my Southron Escort out whenever I want, is just really strong. And I really, really do not like this design space. But I do think this is an A card. I think Martell has some of the strongest economy and strongest draw in the game right now. And so I don't really see it being pulled towards Rivergate. So that kind of brings it down, the overall faction, maybe down to a B plus, A minus range for me. But I really hate this Martell card. But it's super strong.
Yeah, I mean, as far as the econ location goes, you're totally right. Martell doesn't really need or want this on either an econ or a draw front. But on top of that, the trigger here is entirely on your opponent. You know, something like, say, the Greyjoy one with initiative, you're at least kind of like fighting for that. And, you know, there's uncertainty in the thought phase about some choices. But Rivergate is all like on the board challenge math options here that your opponent has to play into letting you trigger the Rivergate, which really dings it from even just a basic draw perspective. The Escort, I agree with everything you guys said. There's a lot of sick triggering ability here. And, you know, after all this time we've spent reining in various things, it feels kind of crazy to see something else pop out here that is effectively more supercharging for Flea Bottom. So, yay.
I mean, Flea Bottom's nearly a dead restricted. That's not really a concern. There's just so many damn answers for Flea Bottom right now everywhere that, like, I'm not entirely sure Flea Bottom's even a good card anymore.
I think it is. It's a bold statement. That's maybe a whole episode.
Yeah, I mean, so Stark, Greyjoy, and Targ are the three most popular houses. They don't care about Flea Bottom. The most popular agenda specifically bones Flea Bottom. The most popular agenda specifically means people run Isle of Raven, specifically bones Flea Bottom. The Targ non-limited thing specifically bones Flea Bottom. That's a lot of Flea Bottom answers, and to invest your restricted card with like a semi-real restricted list right now in that interaction, especially in Martell, where it's like that's Dorn or Trade Routes, is
Dorn's is vulnerable to the agenda issues as Flea Bottom is. So then you're looking at Trade Routes.
I didn't Dorn say is not to, as vulnerable to any of those issues. Dorn is specifically to the agenda, right? I mean, like, so
all locations are vulnerable to the agenda.
Yeah, so. But like, that's kind of just a thing you deal with, right?
I think the problem isn't that I think Glazer is right in this in an important sense. Flea Bottom has a real opportunity cost now because of the just like where the restricted list is. So I think if Flea Bottom wasn't restricted, it wouldn't have any of the problems Glazer is describing. Because it's just a one gold location. If they, you know, you're trading, like they put to the torch your Flea Bottom, that's a relatively fair exchange if Flea Bottom's not restricted. But if you're choosing it as your restricted card, you are giving up a huge opportunity cost at this point, even in a place it wasn't 3 months ago. And that's where really why it's becoming increasingly less playable is simply because there's so much location hate out there right now that it's just like not worth giving up trade routes. It's not worth giving up wars to come. It's not worth giving up other restricted cards that are escaping me right now, with Sea of Blood so powerful, with Greyjoy so powerful. If for some reason it fell off the restricted list, there's no opportunity cost, really.
Yeah, I was going to say, hopefully it's not for a whole host of it.
But yes, you were correct.
It won't, but... all right. So... at the neutral cards, and the first neutral card is a 6 gold, obviously non-loyal, unique character, Ooh. Green and blue icons, 4 strength, Littlefinger, hey-oh, he's back, Petire is back, ally, lord, small council, shadow 6, stealth, reaction, after a character you control comes out of shadows, place 3 cards from your hand, up to 3 cards, that's important, excuse me. Place up to 3 cards from your hand on the bottom of your deck in any order, then draw that many cards. Limit once per round. This little figure is expensive, but extremely strong neutral card filtering. The stealth gives him utility and challenges, although 4 strength right now makes him very vulnerable to burn. So the question is, do you want to risk in challenges? You know, your 7 gold event, or no, not even 7, 8 gold if you bring him out of shadows. But, you know, 6 gold makes him pretty safe to some pretty common character hate. You know, 6 gold plays pretty well with Valerdo Harris. I think you'll see him in shadows decks. I think he's a B- card just simply because of the expense to vulnerability level, but I would love to hear what you guys think.
I think he's completely and totally insane. Is that that's a thought, right? Like, he is just an amazing, amazing card. Like, Tyrell Lannister and Martell absolutely love him, and their shadows builds run him.
How many copies, Glazer? 1 or 3?
Targ is still real big in the meta, so 1. But, like, I really want more than 1. Like, maybe 2. I mean, just the card filter here is completely amazing and busted. Tyrell and Martell especially, because they can just cheat him into play, are phenomenal, phenomenal cards with this. Like, that he has stealth is completely silly. Like, you can just marshal him, right? Like, you can use your, like, whatever to marshal him and then just use all your other shadow shit to make him happen. He's... like, I think he's better than Varys, and, like, I think he's just phenomenal. Just a completely incredible card. He's an A card.
I just think he's so vulnerable. Like,
so what?
I just think you're spending... burn! Like, I mean, I guess you could just sit him on the board, but then you're paying 6 gold.
You're really wasting that.
To filter through up to 3 cards, which is really strong, don't get me wrong.
Every turn.
I just think. Yeah.
I mean, like, it's not three cards, it's filter 3 cards every single turn.
Yeah. No, I don't think you're wrong. I just think that he feels vulnerable to me. He feels like it's a huge economic output, in a world where you need to be bringing cards in and out of shadows for him to work. Obviously, you're right that Tyrell with Queen of Thorns and Martell with the girl who trades people in and out of shadows have ways of sort of cheating him into play. The factions that can cheat him into play obviously want to run 2. I think 2 is probably the right number, Glazer. But like other factions. Even playing assault, I don't necessarily think that he is going to be always worth the investment.
always is a funny word, right? Like, is he literally every time going to be amazing? Probably not. Is it often enough that I feel comfortable? Almost certainly.
I mean, that might be true, but, like, Put to the Sword is back in the meta. Like, maybe a year ago, Littlefinger would be extremely safe. You know, where maybe Burn's the only thing that could get him, but with Greyjoy, with a lot of other factions also playing Solid Sea of Blood, and Put is really back in the meta, like, this is Put bait. Like, then you're paying 6 to 8 gold to filter 3, 8 gold to filter 3 if Littlefinger's your trigger, and then they put your dude to the sword. Like, I don't know. Again, like, I just think that Littlefinger, he doesn't protect himself. He's expensive. Like, I think he's a fantastic card, but, like, at 4 strength, no military icon, I think that puts him in, like, the high B range. But not A.
I mean, he can sort of protect himself, right? In a theoretical sense, a little bit like 6-drop Victarion, right? Vulnerable early, but, you know, it's not going to take many Littlefinger triggers here till he hits a dupe of himself if you are playing those. So, depends, I would say, kind of on your board state at the time. Can you afford, with other effects you've got, to fend off a Put to the Sword for a turn or two? I don't know.
Yeah. It's...
I mean, because he's going to be a 5-card churn per turn, right? Because I assume you're going to be trying to trigger that turn, right? So 2 draw plus 3 from him, that's quite a bit of a 60-card deck that you start moving through.
Yep, he's just completely unreal filter. It's just he only goes in those that one deck type. But, like, in that deck type, man, is he good.
Fair.
I've got my fingers crossed that maybe this is a piece of Lanny Shadows.
Look,
good.
Shadows,
they would still rather have draw, I think, but the filter might...
Look, if Shadows pushes Sea of Blood out of the meta, I will be an incredibly happy man, so...
Well, the problem is Shadows wants to rely on locations, which Sea of Blood likes to eat. Like, Sea of Blood is more a predator for Shadows than vice versa, yeah. Is the problem.
That's true. They want that income, among other things.
Mm-hmm. And they take eternity to get set
and
up.
That's, and so decks like that, Sea of Blood preys on. Yeah.
You have to get word presence.
I need to. All right, whatever. But this is not the Sea of Blood hate show. So let's get on to...
Yes, it is. That is literally the point of this show. All right.
Will, you want to do At the Gates?
Yeah, let's see. At the Gates is going to be a plot. That one is a 4 gold. Gosh, I almost said cost. 0 initiative, 1 claim, 7 reserve, city and kingdom. And says, when revealed, search your deck for a limited location with printed cost 1 or lower. Reveal it and add it to your hand, or put it into play instead if there are no city plot cards in your used pile. Shuffle your deck. So, here you go, as long as this is the first of your city plot. By the way, woo-hoo, for city plots making a return to the game, even though they look to be a little different this time around. Anyway, you know, so here's your way to go ahead and grab one of these brand new econ locations and drop it straight into play and sidestep that whole limited restriction. So... man, in that case, does that make a 5-0-1 with a delayed draw worth it? I'm not so sure. I feel like it's going to need better stats if that is the main use. Other one cost cards you might get, though, I guess... King's Road is going to turn this into a 7-0-1, which looks...
It's not what you go get.
Do what? Well, it's got to be limited.
You go so get Gates of the Moon.
Oh, Gates. Gates. There we go.
Gates, if you go Gates of the Moon, and if you're Greyjoy, I guess, you can see if going Great Hall works. Because the second you have two great halls in Greyjoy, the entire game plays
differently. Absolutely. Great Hall is an easy one. A deck running at the gates might just include one of its factions limited, like the new ones, just because. Yeah.
Just to search late game. Well, but you've got a loop on plots, right? Because the search only, it's the put into play.
Well, just like, you know, and just, you know, let's say you set up your at the gates, you know, well, not at the gates, your Gates of the Moon, and, you know, you want another decent target that's not necessarily a Rose Road if your deck is not necessarily relying on Great Halls. But it's like super, this is very strong. This is the strongest opener that Danny has printed since Jesse Carpenter's favorite card, Time of Plenty, or Summer Harvest. Although did Time of Plenty come out before or after Summer Harvest? I can't remember.
Time of Plenty
was after. So since Time of Plenty, it's just a very safe opener. I mean, maybe people will start playing Naval if At the Gates becomes just super ubiquitous, but it's still really strong. You know, just plopping it just smooths out the inconsistency of economy that can really punish some decks, and like has held Greyjoy back sometimes, has held Stark back sometimes, and of course has held Bera back. Like Bera, this is a big boon to Bera. So it would be interesting to see what this card does for the meta. I think the problem is that it's of course neutral. So the rich get richer alongside, you know, rising tide doesn't raise all, it raises all boats, but some boats started up a lot higher up.
Some boats are more equal than others.
So this is an A plot though.
Yeah, no, I think it's great. I'm just a little bored with it. It feels a little shoehorny, you know, as far as my options here. So like, it's hard for me to get actively excited about it, though I recognize it's relatively efficient. So, yeah.
You rate it, Glazer?
It's an S.
S, okay. Fair.
It's unfreaking believable, I think is the best way to put it. Like, it is a truly phenomenal, phenomenal card. I think it really, really changes the way shadow decks play in a big way, because like getting a +1 gold from the start, any deck like with non-limited econ, if you can have +4 or +5 econ on turn one, because this will not count as your limited play unless I'm incorrect.
No,
right?
It doesn't count.
So this not being your limited, if you can set up a non-limited, get a Rose Road or a C or a whatever they're called, the negative ones, the reducers out, then you can get a +2, then you can plop another gold out. Like, you're set for gold for the game. And like, that's the point where a lot of these new econ locations start to make more sense, because like, if you're at +4 gold from turn one, or plus like even 5 gold from turn one, like your econ is now set for the game, and any econ you draw from then on out is just an extra card. This is meta changing.
Cool. All right. So, Glazer, do you want to read City of Secrets?
Sure. If I can get it. But I went the wrong way. City of Secrets is a 4/4/1 reserve 8 city. When revealed, each player draws 2 cards. Then each player, without a city plot in his or her used pile, chooses and discards 2 cards from his or her hand. I'm very happy that these two came out together, because City of Secrets is the reason to play At the Gates and not Riddle to open. Because if you're playing City of Secrets, you are very likely to be running At the Gates. This card makes a lot of sense. It's the best draw 2 card, economy draw 2 that doesn't have a 0 reserve. The 8 reserve is real, real nice. The 4 initiative isn't bad. And it can just, your opponent gets filter, but they still have to discard those cards, so that's pretty nice. It would be good if they had Fleabottom, but I don't think Fleabottom is super good right now.
Well, I was going to say, though, if you want to play Fleabottom and play this without the other city, like, you could, you know, these type of effects, you could overrun opposing Isle of Ravens.
I mean,
large targets.
You could. Like, that's a thing that makes sense to do. But it's only once, right? Like, sticking two cards in your discard, and, like, they better both be Fleabottom targets is only getting you one turn of Fleabottom.
This and Ravages and things of that nature.
I mean,
you could build that one direction if you wanted.
I mean, you're also missing that there are decks that Fleabottom or not Fleabottom want to put cards in their discard pile. And, like, I mean, this is a combo enabling plot.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that's what's missing. I think that it could easily be an opener in a combo deck.
It's not quite wheels within wheels, but like it almost reads as a toned down, more balanced version of wheels.
You know, the filter is pretty good in that case for you. But we're not even necessarily talking about hard combo. It could be Fleabottom decks. It could just be decks that have discard pile synergies that it wants. Yeah, so I think this card is really strong. It's strong as a fair card, the way Glazer was describing it, where you go things like At the Gates, some other plot, City of Secrets to refill. Very, 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 very strong. Yeah, it's the highest gold on a... Well, no, I guess...
You win and you die, probably, but...
No, I'm talking about... I guess you win and you die has the highest gold of any draw plot.
Yeah, of anything that doesn't have zero, is what I said. But yeah,
I
just think it's good.
Yeah, or I guess Time of Plenty. I don't think the Jesse and the accepting combo decks, the Jesse and the Wausau people of the world will not like this plot. Because of course it causes both players to draw two cards, right? So if those two cards could be better cards than what they had in their hand, and they just chuck the two worst cards. You definitely, I do think if you play City of Secrets, you need to be playing Targaryen or Greyjoy, where you have faith that, to a lesser extent, Martell, where you have a faith that every top deck in your deck is better than your opponent's. I don't think I don't think most other factions have that. So,
Lannister. I mean, Cersei loves this, right?
It's true. It does. She does.
I get like Doc Cersei, if you can get that working. Yeah,
biggest Cersei.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That seems
not limit one per plot deck.
It's true.
Yeah, that seems real, real good. Like, you just, if they don't play cities, and like, I feel like City of Secrets means that people just generally open with At the Gates. Like, it's just like.
Yeah, I mean.
At least for. Like, City of Secrets is an amazing play until people start opening At the Gates.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if At the Gates is as ubiquitous, I think it will be at first, City of Secrets is a little bit of a sleeper. So I put it at like a B minus, excuse me. But I think over time, particularly once we see more city plots, I think, excuse me, because I assume based on this design that we'll see more of them, that could become better over time. But we'll see. Or worse over time, I guess, if everyone's playing cities.
Well, if they're good enough, they might get there. But the first couple we were seeing here definitely seem to have a little bit of a different slant than the first edition cities did. So maybe they won't be as ubiquitous.
So that brings us to the final neutral card, which is a 2 gold, obviously non-loyal, unique location, White Sword Tower, King's Landing. Each Kingsguard character you control gets +1 strength. Each player that does not control a Kingsguard character cannot play more than one event each phase. I think this is a D card. I don't really have much to say. Like, maybe if you want to play a Kingsguard theme deck, maybe this points to... I mean, we got Man and More in this pack. Maybe this points to us getting more Kingsguard cards, excuse me. But just, like, cannot play more than one event each phase. Like, I mean, unless, again, combo is back in real force, you know, usually it's just the one event that they need to really bone you. And so it's not a huge drawback for your opponent. So, again, this is a D card.
Yeah, it's just not quite filling me with confidence here. The Kingsguard stuff is going to quite get there. I mean, obviously, from what we've seen with this cycle, that's one of the things they're pushing is for a Kingsguard deck to come together, which, you know, based on the Kingsguards we've seen that reference Kingsguard, kind of worries me. Like, I assume we're going to see a retread of the first ed white book agenda, which didn't wow me back in the day. So, like, come on, FFG, just really blow me away with the white book this time around, because, like, for agendas named after podcasts, like, the worst to come really set a really high bar. I'm going to need to be wowed by some Kingsguard stuff.
All right.
Yeah. So
I digress from this particular card because I was that unimpressed.
I just think it's a bad card, right? Like, I'm not sure what to do with it. It's an F unless we get some amazing ass Kingsguard. Like, I'm not sure why I'd ever play this.
And still, the only thing it does for Kingsguard itself is just give plus one strength. Like, I just don't know why you'd ever pay two gold for this effect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But c'est la vie. We'll just give it a D or an F and
move
on. That's
the plan.
All right, Will, lay on us the Flea Bottom Alley.
Oh, we're on tonight's watch. Flea Bottom Alley is the one-drop limited location King's Landing trait. So this one says, marshaling action, kneel and sacrifice Flea Bottom Alley to put a Night's Watch character with printed cost 3 or lower into play from your hand, then draw one card. And we get the Aged Craftsman character. 3 cost, power icon, 1 strength, not loyal, builder trait, no attachments, and reaction. After Aged Craftsman enters play, search the top 10 cards of your deck for a Night's Watch location with printed cost 2 or lower, and put it into play. Shuffle your deck. Wow, I'm actually very intrigued by both of these, honestly. Flea Bottom Alley, I think, looks like a very interesting homage to Flea Bottom itself in a much more balanced form. The limited trade-off, the sacrifice, though you do get the character into play permanently. Granted, also it's coming from hand rather than from your discard pile. So, oh gosh, now that I look at that more, maybe I dislike that trade-off more because the character has to have printed cost 3 or lower, which means from an economic standpoint, this is a harder bar to hit than King's Road, since you can't reduce something of greater cost, and then you only draw one out of this. You know what? I think I'm actually talking myself into liking Flea Bottom Alley less than I wanted to. A lot comes up there, and marshaling action doesn't let me play around with the timing to do something particularly interesting to make that trade-off worth it. So, you know, actually, I'm not sure if I'm sold. Aged Craftsman, though, I love these kind of search effects, and Night's Watch definitely has some options of things you want to go get. Turns out he's a builder, so I might enjoy searching the top 10 cards of my deck for a, the names blur together. What's that? Abandoned Fort or something?
Abandoned Stronghold.
Stronghold. There we go. Or, hell, Castle Black, I wouldn't complain about.
Or Brandon's Gift. Which you can still trigger because the builder came into play, and so thus you get an economic advantage. So
exactly,
yeah, it's
exactly.
Super strong card.
Yeah, Aged Craftsman is just crazy straightforward, efficient. It is very, very good. So that's where I am.
Cajun Craftsman is phenomenal. Hey, Roy, what won your tournament again? Yeah, Builders is good, and Asian Craftsman is completely nuts in that deck. Builders would also love to run Flea Bottom Alley. I just don't think they can, right? Like,
I mean, spots are really tight. Like, it would require a lot of rethinking of what the econ base is to make it work. You know, like, the ability to make it free pretty easily in Night's Watch, particularly in Builders, the fact that you have the Sworn Brothers and you have gift triggers, and the fact that, you know, it's a gift trigger that can generate, like, a huge economic advantage. I think Will misses that, like, a lot of Night's Watch's best characters cost three or less.
Sure.
So, you know, until Castle Black Mason rotates, you know, just the ability to convert this to even one gold and draw a card, right? So that ability that this card replaces itself in your hand, or replaces the card that you put into play, is really strong in Builders. You know, and there's just, like, the thing about Flea Bottom Alley is it just, like, unlocks so many synergies. Like, I mean, you don't even need to really look outside of just the ability to go Flea Bottom Alley, put a Aged Craftsman into play, search the top 10 cards of your deck for a location, put it into play. Like, you're just getting a huge amounts of tempo very quickly. And there are tricks that you can do to sort of play around your opponent's location control with Flea Bottom Alley, or even character control or character, you know, tricks by the fact that, you know, since it's just a marshalling action, if you're going second, they do something, you'd be like, all right, marshalling action, put this into play. Like, particularly, you can do that with the three drop builder that gives you gold. You know, if you're going second and while your opponent's marshalling, you can put that into play. So when you do count gold, you'll be up gold. There's just lots of really cool interactions with Flea Bottom Alley. We'll see, but spots are really tight. Like, spots even for Aged Craftsman are really tight. Like, I think Aged Craftsman is a ridiculously strong card. It is an A card, close to S tier card, but it does have some significant drawbacks. It has just one strength, and it can't take blades, which is a huge thing for a three cost builder. Like, a huge thing. But its ability to fetch the gift, fetch Castle Black, fetch Abandoned Stronghold, even Shadow Tower, is really, really, really powerful. And I think you'll see two or three of these in Builders decks, but I actually think that no attachments at all is a huge weakness to this card, and makes Builders decks a little bit more vulnerable to things like Sea of Blood. And so it'll be interesting to see the effect that Aged Craftsman has on that very sketchy matchup. So this is an A pack, though, for Night's Watch.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's
strong.
Do you
disagree, Glazer?
I mean, you basically nailed it. Like, I'm not 100% sold on what the hell to do with Flea Bottom Alley, but Aged Craftsman is a completely bonkers card. Like, you would love that if it could take blades, but, like, Enters Play is real good, right? Like, this card is just, wait, like, do you, like, just a Haunted Forest on demand is so huge if you time it right.
Or, I mean, you could also put the two cost limited into play, right? And then this becomes then it becomes a one gold card, right?
Right.
Or one to two gold card. Super strong. I'm excited. Hopefully, I'll be able to figure out where these go in my Builders deck for Jesse's tournament. So, all right. So, Glazer, you want to lay on us the busted start cards?
Alisane Mormont is a 3-for-2 military power. No, a House Mormont lady. She is not loyal. No attachments except weapon, but her text makes her functionally loyal. While each character you control has the Stark affiliation, Alisane gains stealth during military challenges and doesn't kneel when declared as attacker military challenges. Meanwhile, we have the Old Gate, which is the one cost limited from Stark that gives +1 gold to King's Landing location. If each character you control has the Stark affiliation, sack Old Gate to draw 2 cards. Oh, so both of these are completely busted and Stark is an S. Cool. I mean, Old Gate is just economy that, like, you're definitely eventually going to draw from because you're just not going to run Don Stark cards in your Stark deck. And Alisane is completely stupid, especially in Sea of Blood.
Well, why is she no attachments except weapon? Like, because I don't,
she
like,
might
that's...
be otherwise balanced? I don't know.
No. Like, I really... like, I dislike that on these characters that have these, like, busted effects.
I mean, she can get
that,
venomous
that they just can't take attachments at all. She can't. That's
go.
True. She,
you know, and actually, even
she
a weapon.
Get venomous bladed. She can also get pinched.
Mm-hmm.
So
there you go.
Doesn't also that Martell, is that Martell zero cost attachment that puts poison counters on characters? Is that a weapon, Glazer?
No, it is not.
Oh,
it's just a condition.
Lingering venom.
It's just a condition. Okay. Yeah. So.
I'm very intrigued and confused here. Like, on the back of Alisane and core Arya, actually, I think even two drop Arya, right? Like, it is Stark, like, effectively the second stealthiest house in the game. Maybe not necessarily on total card count, but, like, on actual prevalence of what is going to see play, like, and actually be out on the board. That feels super
wrong.
Weird
Lord's
to me,
wrong.
But I also think, like, wrong inaccurate or
see.
Wrong unnetted.
With her, there are, what, three Stark cards that consistently see play with stealth? So there's Mira, Alisane, who I assume is at least going to be a one of, if not more, in every Stark deck. And then Core Arya sees at least one copy in every Stark deck, so that's pretty high.
And they're all low investment, like, they're very easily played. I don't know, it just feels very bizarre to me for Stark to field the most stealth. Maybe that's the way to put it, compared to anybody other than Greyjoy.
Yeah, I mean, Stark, if you're playing against Stark, just be mid-range Stark, just be ready for them to be constantly shuffling their deck, because with Skagos, and then this brings the Mormont Search Girls back into the meta. You know, the fact that you now have her and Dacey that you can tutor out, there's like a really strong mid-range Mormont package out there for Stark players that I expect we will see in a lot of mid-range Stark decks along the lines of Wama's Worlds deck, that will be very strong in the meta, possibly out of Sea of Blood.
Sounds fun.
So. Well, we'll win games. All right. Yeah. So I'd say this is definitely an A house. Glazer, you said S, right?
You know, I'm just thinking on the A scale myself. I think Old Gate's respectable, but is going to suffer many of the same problems the others run into, so I'm going to be a little lower.
Well, this, I believe that these two cards, at least to me, are an S tier of a different type, which brings us to the Targ cards. So Targ has a 5 cost character, red and blue icons, 4 strength, unique, Viserion, loyal, he's a dragon, spoiler alert, ambush 5, no attachments, reaction, after you win a challenge in which Viserion is attacking, discard 1 card from your hand to have Viserion gain intimidate until end of the challenge, and then it's 1 gold, loyal, limited card is the Dragon Gate, King's Landing, limited, challenges action. If you control 2 or more attachments, sacrifice Dragon Gate to draw 2 cards, yep. +1 gold. I think both of these cards are bad. I think Viserion, like a 5 cost Viserion that costs you a card to gain intimidate when there's already Quotho. You can run Quoth, or not Quoth. What is the icon +1 that has intimidate that you can bring in any
Kaholo, and then you can just play the two cost Viserion and for a similar situation. Like, I just think Targ already has this effect and it's not eating up a unique spot that it wants. Viserion is just such an important card to Drak-based Targaryen strategies, and because you want a cheap dragon that you are okay with kneeling for Dracarys, and this effect's just not that great. Like, it doesn't need another discard outlet. It doesn't really do anything interesting at all compared to its biggest brother, but even compared to Rhaegal, this card's pretty garbagey. And then Dragon Gate, like, maybe in some combo Danny build, you'll see this card, but like a regular mid-range Targaryen build or an aggro Targaryen build, like, I just don't think you're going to want to do this, particularly when with things becoming more killy for Targaryen since the restricted list, like the Slaver's Bay ports are back in. And with Marinese Market, the best non-limited economy, and now one of the best second two-cost limiteds, plus Illyrio's estates, like, you don't need economy. And of course, Targaryen doesn't super need draw. So, yeah. Why would you want bad attachments to make this card work? So this is a D faction across the board this round.
Cool. Yeah, I mean, I don't know what else to add here. Dragon's Gate has one of the weakest triggers, even though it's under your control by relying on a card type that relies on another card type. So you're like moving multiple pieces to try and get that to work, plus all of the other issues we've already addressed with these type of locations. And Viserion just doesn't have the punch that I expect or need to have that trade-off over a hatchling. If he just had hard intimidate, I would look at it, especially that ambush. But as is, an ongoing investment in discarding cards to that is not appealing to me. I don't know if I go as low as Roy, though, but maybe like a C minus.
I think I have them at an S, and I just don't think this is any good.
Ooh, we had a spread just, there. Maybe some of the most we've had.
I don't know what to say about these, except they're like not good cards, right? Like, I just don't like them.
I mean, they're just garbage. I think the experiment of these bigger dragons, the only one that really worked out was Drogon, and Drogon was overpushed. So I don't know. Well, this will hopefully make Targaryen fans hold their breath for better big dragons in the prospective Targ box. So. You ready to bring us home, Will?
Oh boy, Tyrell it is. We've got the 6-cost Knight of Flowers, military and power icon, 5-strength non-loyal, Kingsguard and Knight, Shadows 5, Renown and Reaction. After a card you control comes out of Shadows, choose and stand a Kingsguard character. Limit twice per round. And, of course, their one-drop econ, Gates of the Gods. This one is King's Landing in the 7 trait, limited, challenges action. If you control a character with the highest strength in play, sacrifice Gate of the Gods to draw 2 cards. And, of course, this one gold. Gate of the Gods, I think, is probably going to be one of the weakest of these in comparison to the rest of the card pool of that house. Much like Martell, Tyrell is just not hurting for income or draw. I just don't know that this has a home for them when they have so many other better options. Knight of Flowers is up against some pretty stiff competition in his other versions for just kind of your general decks or maybe Tinder Marge decks or what have you, but maybe could be a piece of some more Shadows tech coming together. Of course, you know, minimum, he can stand himself when you bring something else out of Shadows. So maybe there will be some kind of Kingsguard deck that comes together. Other options we already have in the pool, like Kingsguard and Jamie or Sir Mandon Moore, don't really fill me with enthusiasm for working in an interesting way with this ability, but at least you could get a couple renowned challenges off the night. So if more pieces come together, I'll be looking at revising that upward, but you know, at minimum for himself in a Shadows deck, I do like
it. He basically stand himself, right?
Yeah. That's like, the kind of basic level.
Two stands for coming out of Shadows isn't bad if you're running Marjorie, right? Like, not Marjorie, Queen of Thorns.
Yeah,
like he should probably be five cost, because like it's not like he's easy to use. But no, he's a good little card. Their new card is useless, but like, spoiler, they don't really care about economy. So like, really, who cares? But overall, this is super good for them. Like, not super good. It's super good for their one interesting build. Trell has a lot of really, really shitty, boring builds. But Knight of Flowers goes in there one good one. So I don't know. I'm going to say a C+.
Yeah, I think C is probably where they are. I mean, like I think Knight of Flowers is going to be a one of in Tyrell Assault builds. If there is ever a Kingsguard build, maybe you'll see that as well. But he's a little too expensive. Maybe if he had been 5 for 4, he would have been a little bit 5 base cost 4 shadows, or maybe just like 5 base cost 5 shadows would have been fine. Yeah. But like, yeah, he's a little expensive for what he does, but he gives some closing power to that assault deck, and so I think he'll see some play. And then, like, I just want to just emphasize this. There's literally no reason to play Gate. Well, that's not true. There's few reasons to play Gate of the Gods, because Tyrell already has good economy cards that it can't play because it just doesn't have room for them. It has good draw cards that it often doesn't play because decks don't have room for them. This one combines the two, I guess. But like, when you're in a faction that has non-rotating amazing cards like Red Wine Straits, right? And it just got a really great non-limited econ card that does everything it wants to do. When, you know, like, maybe this is as good as an Arbor Vineyard, but like in Tyrell Summer builds, Arbor Vineyard is busted. So it just like fits awkwardly in a faction that already has Pleasure Barges and Septons and Spies and just
maces stuff. And high gardens. Also,
so you just, you know, I just don't think you're gonna see this. So I would give the faction overall a C.
Wow, that's really I mean, I guess I gave it a C+. I thought you were gonna go lower.
No, just a C. Like, I think Knight of Flowers is acceptable. He's a C card, and then I will forget that the one cost Tyrell location exists. So it's basically a non-card.
Yeah. that's a kind way of putting it. I'll just forget it exists.
Like, it's not bad where you like look at it and you're like, oh man, why did they print this card? It's just I'll just miss it in my binder every time I'm flipping through the Tyrell cards. Mm. So what do we think of the pack overall, gentlemen?
Overall, at least, I think I like it. If nothing else, I didn't really mention this earlier. I do like that all of these econ cards are getting dumped on us at once rather than kind of dribbling them out like prior packs have done, where the meta has kind of like lurched from one faction to another based on who has the hottest, newest econ cards. I would much rather have that kind of thing drop in one lump sum, so I approve.
Yeah, I think it's a really cool direction that they went in. I think this is a pretty strong start to the new cycle. There's going to be some new economy cards that will help some factions. And there's some really powerful busted cards. And there's a new plot that, as Glazer said, has a good potential of reshaping the metagame here in the form of At the Gates. So it'll be interesting to see where the meta goes. And we've had such a drought of cards, and the metagame is really starting to curdle. So I'm really excited to see where these cards push us going forward.
Yeah. Do you think so? You think the cards in the pack specifically are going to really kind of shake things up, or more just the excitement of thank God we have new cards is going to force people into rethinking for a bit?
I mean, people always like to play with new cards. So at least one tournament I go to, there'll be a little bit less Greyjoy, a little less Sea of Blood, why people play around with these cards. I do think At the Gates empowers some strategies that aren't Sea of Blood or aren't just Sea of Blood. So
that sounds like a good thing.
Yeah, hopefully. So just as long as I see less Sea of Blood in tournaments, I will be a happy man, particularly Greyjoy.
Does Greyjoy see a problem? I haven't noticed.
Haven't heard a thing. All right, props and slops.
Props to Sentinels of the Multiverse. Oblivion is really cool so far.
I'm definitely going to have to check that out. I do love me some Sentinels.
Mm-hmm.
Slops to being sick for 2 weeks. Awesome. Like, I've been like on and off. I had the flu for like a week. And I had to work through most of it. It was not very fun. Not very fun at all. So, yeah. Not fun at all. So, slops to that. I don't really have any props. Although, props to the Dragon Prince. Al and I watched that since the last episode of this I was on. That was really enjoyable. So, you should watch that, folks.
I definitely need to check that out.
Yeah, you and Carlos should watch that, Glazer. It's good.
Heard of it.
It's like, yeah,
I mean,
on Netflix. It's like an animated show.
I didn't know it existed.
Yeah,
but now I will.
Weren't some of the folks doing it involved with Avatar, Lester Bender?
Yep, it was one of the head writer of the original Avatar series.
Yeah,
not the creators, but just like their head of their writers' room.
Okay, so. Gotcha.
Very cool.
Yeah,
that's so.
Yeah.
Still pretty sweet, I think.
Was I on the show since I saw Captain Marvel? Because that was also something to prop, I guess.
You know, I don't remember. I don't think so.
So, yeah. Captain Marvel was very enjoyable.
It was... Keep going.
Yeah, it was enjoyable. I enjoyed it. It wasn't my favorite Marvel movie, but I really enjoyed it. And I'm excited to see where the character goes in the Marvel universe going forward.
It was fun. And I would definitely agree that I'm excited to see where things go going forward. The little snippet in the Endgame trailer, I think it's no spoiler for anybody listening to the show that she'll be around for Endgame. That little snippet there already felt more like Carol to me than the Captain Marvel movie did. So I'm excited to see more.
Fair enough. I really did enjoy it. I thought it was a very... I think the first movies have a hard job at this point. And like...
Yeah, yeah.
This in particular is the first... This is going to sound dumb. This is the first movie since...
Probably?
Black Panther... Black Panther and Spider-Man are
kind of movies. But
that's the idea, right? Like, that's what I was kind of getting at. Like, they're new movies, but they're not really new movies, right? Like, they're not new ideas. The properties were introduced elsewhere. Carol got a pager introduction, yeah. And, like, they had to do this whole thing. Like, I don't know. I really enjoyed it for what it was. I thought,
yeah.
I think all the first Marvel movies follow the same basic formula, and hers was enough of a shake-up that it was at least, like...
They do.
Interesting. And, like, I really... Like, a lot of people didn't like the beginning of the movie. They're like, the beginning just was so draggy. And I don't know, like... But
it was
like,
a little draggy, in my opinion. Geek,
I was totally fine with that. I was just like, cool! Look, a bunch of things I recognize from comic books. I like the comic books.
See, I'm not even sure they did enough with that stuff. Like, I feel like they glossed over.
They had a lot to get.
I don't know. I guess maybe just the pacing felt uneven. It kind of lurched back and forth, I felt. But this maybe isn't nits and picks rather than props and slots.
Yeah, I mean, well, for me, like... I'm not a big fan of amnesia plots in general, so that kind of, like, began, particularly the beginning of the movie when it was getting going and slowed it down, but, like, the movie was just carried by Brie Larson through the whole thing, so even when there are moments like, oh, this isn't my favorite part of a Marvel movie I've ever watched, I'm just like, whoa, Brie Larson is, like, very powerful on screen, she's got a lot of charisma, she's, like, breathing life into this character, so I just kept appreciating the character and the film's interpretation of her. In a way that, like, even when I was like, of course, all right, she's got amnesia, okay, all right, whatever, it's the 90s. I was still like, oh, okay, I'm really excited to see where they take the character. So while, like, I had, like, middling attitudes towards the movie, like, I was really, like, invested in Brie Larson's interpretation of the character by the end.
So interesting that we had such, like, radically opposite reactions. I really felt that either script or direction or possibly performance really hampered her. I felt virtually no connection to Carol all movie, which was kind of a bummer. And I am curious. I know you're something of a comic guy, Roy. Are you, like, is the Carol Danvers Captain Marvel a character you follow much? Not much, somewhere in the middle.
I exited full-time comics fandom right before the DeConnick, maybe not even right before, like 2 or 3 years before the DeConnick run. So no, my sister, on the other hand, is like obsessive is not a strong enough word for my sister's feelings towards the modern Carol Danvers interpretation. So I guess maybe vicariously I got that, like, but I have no real attachment to the modern Captain Marvel. I don't have any attachment to Captain Marvel at all as a comic book fan. Like, he was a shitty blue dude when I was reading the most comics. So the sun.
He's never been blue.
Genus Vell was in fact blue.
Yeah.
Like, oh, Genus. Okay. Yeah. I guess I think of him as black more often because he normally had his cosmic awareness turned on.
So, like, and that black the Peter David effect. Captain Marvel run.
That was a good run.
Is as much like a Captain Marvel run that I, like, know well. Like, I've gone back and read some of the DeConnick stuff, but, like, it's not something that's, like, really drawn me in, which is fine. Like, not everything is for me. But I know it means a lot to other people. So,
I was just kind of curious from talking to folks if the ones that felt Brie Larson was pretty flat are ones that are very attached to the comic character, like, for instance, Kristen, my wife is, and thought that she didn't quite get there in the film, versus folks that really enjoyed it, maybe don't, you know, follow the comics, you know, kind of the books versus the movie thing, you know.
Yeah, my sister,
it's always going to come up.
Loved it. So, like, saw it like 4 times before she went to England. So, I don't know if that vouches for hardcore. I mean, she owns a jacket that's the Captain Marvel, like, costume and a dress and all that stuff. So.
Yeah. Yeah, the new one from her universe. at Hot Topic? Yeah, Kristen got one of those too. The jacket is really
anyway, nice. I enjoyed it. I will definitely prop it, and I'm excited to see where the character goes in Endgame and all that good stuff. And so. All right.
Yeah. I'll just prop Marvel in general real quick if I can. I'm like, every time I watch one of these Marvel movies, it puts me in this big Marvel mood where I want to go immerse myself in the MCU again. And thank goodness there's a bunch of stuff I haven't finished watching yet. So I'm back to watching Netflix stuff. And I really enjoy that world. And now that I'm in Punisher season 2, despite the fact that its plot is kind of meandering all over the place and it is not nearly as tight as season 1, I just love John Bernthal, and I really wish I'd gotten to see that comic book Civil War moment where Cap is just beating the hell out of him and he's just taking it. Anybody that's read Civil War may also know that part. Really wish I'd gotten to see that on the silver screen. Oh well. I may be the only one on the cast that enjoyed that.
I don't like Punisher.
Oh, it was.
So
it
I
was
just
you.
Don't watch Punisher things.
He's never been a character I've cared for much, other than that one passage in Civil War, which really sold me a bit on that character, right? Because it kind of presents this whole Jaime Lannister type of thing where. Basically where Cap is beating the snot out of him because he's a murderer and he just killed some people in front of Cap, and Spider-Man's kind of watching this happen. He's like, why is he just letting him do this? And I forget whoever it is he's talking to says, you know, like, you don't understand, man, like, Cap's his hero, like, that's who he grew up wanting to be, but he came out of a very different society and a very different war into a very different place than Cap. And, you know, that's one of the things I always love about Jaime Lannister is, you know, he wanted to be the Sword of the Morning and somehow became the Smiling Knight on the way. I'm fascinated by that.
I have mouth foaming hatred of everything having to do with Mark Millar's Civil War. So I say we should close a chapter on this episode of The White Book before we stumble into the danger zone.
Good night, everybody. We'll be right back.